720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Hewitt here on the Wintrust Business Lunch with you till 1 o'clock. Lots to do on the show today, but you know, earlier on John Williams' show, there was a conversation that's kind of been going all morning, really,
yeah,
about streaming that I think is a really interesting one because, I thought we kind of went through the pivot already, but we're not. We're in another pivot.
Well, it's we got into this conversation because of what's happening with the Cubs broadcasting and the possible additional amount that people have to pay to get the Cubs, and they talk plenty about that. But it was just had me thinking about cord cutting in general and how sports
what do you
is related to that. Right now I have Netflix and Hulu.
You don't have cable?
I don't have cable, no. And I'm mulling a couple other subscriptions, but I haven't dove in yet.
Yeah.
But
well, and that's what happens. I think sometimes it's like people go, oh, well, I'll save all this money. I'm going to go to Hulu, or I'm going to go to like get a Roku or whatever. But then you end up with all of these subscriptions, and you're kind of paying what you pay for cable anyway.
Well, that's what I was bringing up, is the fact that we are still at a point where you can save a lot of money by cutting the cord.
Yeah.
But this story that CNET just put up today about Disney Plus, the Disney streaming service that's coming probably before the end of this year, and a lot of things like it might change that. Because here's a paragraph just to give you an idea. They say, if you're feeling monthly fee fatigue, sorry, but that's the direction that the entertainment business is heading.
Yeah.
So Netflix is going full steam ahead as usual. CBS is pumping its CBS All Access service, which is they already have a couple of shows that are supposedly really good. One called The Good Fight, that's a spinoff from The Good Wife, but you wouldn't know it's not on the air. You have to have that service, and they're going kind of fully in that direction, more with a couple of Star Trek shows apparently. NBC Universal, HBO. Owner Warner Media and Apple are all building their own streaming services. So that's three big ones that are going to have very big content libraries that they're currently sharing with streamers like Netflix. But they're going
to they're ending this streaming deal with Netflix.
Exactly. Yeah. Disney is too, and DC Entertainment is building its own DC Universe streaming service. So.
Well, I mean, what I think will be interesting in the case of Disney Plus in particular is I don't think people realize how much stuff Disney owns.
Yes, yes.
And so when you think Disney, you're like, why would I get that? I don't have kids, or I don't have little kids, or, you know, I think we think Disney brand, but they own so much stuff.
So much. And it is interesting. Disney Plus, they've said, is going to be more family oriented,
mm-hmm.
and Disney stuff that they own that is not as family oriented, they will move to Hulu because they are currently the owners of Hulu too. So that'll be kind of a joint production, and we'll see exactly how that shakes out. But I just think it's interesting, and we're right now in a place where you can still save money by cutting the cord, but it's going to start adding up because everyone's seeing what Netflix is doing and they want to get in on it.
That's right.
And so they're going to start segmenting their library and holding on to their stuff instead of loaning it out. And, if you want to have everything, which it's kind of seems like right now, if you have three subscriptions, you can have access to basically if you have
everything.
Amazon, Hulu, and Netflix, like
you're covered.
Basically everything,
yeah.
In terms of scripted entertainment. And that number is going to go up. It's going to be more like you start to have like six or seven subscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get there, how much money are you really save? I mean, maybe still some, but that is a change that's coming, I think, pretty fast. And the Disney Plus thing that'll be before the end of the year, I think that's going to be a huge step in that direction.
Yeah, agreed. And I think there was an interesting point that you guys brought up earlier about sports availability. I think that's what kept a lot of people on cable, was kind of this idea of, well, I want to just be able to, I want to go right to this. I know I can turn into, you know, this channel and I'm going to see this game. I think that flipping that a little bit and making sports streaming a little more accessible, that's going to probably move a lot of people too away from cable.
And that's why Netflix, it seems like they have like four new shows every day.
Oh yeah.
And 10 movies every week that you can't possibly keep up with the amount of stuff they're producing. Part of the reason they feel so obliged to produce at an insane rate is because they know they're about to lose a lot of the stuff that they're getting from other places. They need to have their own library that they own.
That's right. They've got to kind of batten down the hatches on that. I just think it'll be a really interesting time. And perhaps it'll be, we might see some kind of like defensive move from cable companies of trying to salvage some little thing. I don't know what they could do at this point. I think it's far too late in the game for a cable company to go in and like start buying content and doing something original.
I mean, maybe so. I do believe that we probably have a lot of people listening who still have cable and don't relate to what we're saying about this. And I totally understand that. It is still a slow movement, even though the business has changed. Like, on the consumer end, it might feel relatively the same, but I do think in the next 5 years, it'll look completely different. We don't even know. And the fact is that these companies are playing on different levels too.
Yeah.
Disney is an entertainment company. Netflix seems like an entertainment company, but they're a tech company. So they don't need to be profitable, and they're not.
Right.
Disney is beholden to way more people in a different way.
That's a great point.
And they have, also they're able to generate profit in a way that Netflix can't, because all Netflix has is subscriptions. Disney has huge box office numbers for everything that they own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just they're competing in different ways, but they ultimately want the same thing. It's going to be a weird thing to see shake out.
Yeah, I agree. I think it'll be really interesting to watch. Mm. I would add, I do still have cable, because the only reason is because I have the oldest television possible.
Right.
And I'm just determined to just watch it into the ground. And I can't use any streaming service on it. It doesn't have access to
do
that. So I do have, but I also, it was like part of the package I got for internet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just sort of there. And it's, you know, the most basic thing just so like that television works. But mostly I watch on my laptop or my desktop computer.
Yeah.
I just will watch, like I have a desktop in my bedroom, office / bedroom area. And then I'll just kind of watch on that. That's usually what I do. But I wonder, like, you know, user habit is what really kind of drives us. Like, we saw this with phones when more and more people got rid of landlines. And now not as much conversation is happening about landline. There's some things you have to have a mobile device to do. So I think that part's really interesting. We shall see. That means I'm going to have to get a new television at some point. Good times for me. All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we are going to take a look at a lawsuit against Lockheed Martin, a really, really interesting and very nuanced story about a very, very old site that has been scheduled for cleanup for decades. More on that when we come back here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Winter's Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. So we're joined now by Aaron Gregg, who's a reporter covering the defense industry at Washington Post. And Aaron wrote about a lawsuit against Lockheed Martin. The company is accused of taking part in a fraudulent kickback scheme. It's all related to a contract for nuclear waste disposal at a long decommissioned plutonium plant. So, Aaron, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So talk us through this story. It is really fascinating and rather disturbing, but it's this ongoing story that what at first glance seems like, oh, this is something that just happened, but this has been ongoing for quite a while.
Sure. So this is the latest corruption allegation to come out of the Hanford Nuclear Cleanup Plant. It's in a rural area of southern Washington. For about 40 years, this was the primary source of plutonium for the U.S. nuclear stockpile. But it was shut down in 1987, basically a long, drawn-out cleanup process has been underway since then. But really, it's questionable whether it's gone anywhere. We've spent about $15 to $20 billion there in the last 25 years, and to date, no nuclear waste has been treated yet. So it's quite a puzzling situation.
And so what has kicked up this latest, you know, piece of this conversation? Is it just kind of a, hey, we're running out of time here, or were there health concerns or environmental issues that surfaced anew?
So the current lawsuit is actually just about the idea that the contractors that have been basically hired to clean all of this up are effectively treating this as just a long-term way to draw a lot of profit without really being accountable for their results. So Lockheed Martin was a subcontractor on this cleanup. They apparently awarded a subcontract to a business that they also owned. And around the same time, one of their executives received $1 million payment. It's unclear what exactly that was for, but the Justice Department is alleging that this was literally a fraudulent kickback where he was given this money to arrange a $232 million contract for Lockheed Martin, and then he later left and joined a different unit within the company. When you ask Lockheed Martin about this, they don't deny any of the facts. They just say that their employees didn't do anything wrong. So it's innocent until proven guilty at this point, but the facts definitely won't fall in their favor.
Sure, sure. And when we look at the Energy Department here, there's the timeline of deadlines that have been moved, and what have moved these deadlines throughout this process?
Sure. So basically, the Energy Department has tried a couple of different approaches to this and subsequently abandoned them. The fact of the matter is that nuclear waste cleanup is hard, especially when you're talking about a plant that for 40-plus years was used to produce plutonium throughout the height of the Cold War. This town, about 50,000 workers in it, was just churning out plutonium with really no plan in place for how they would ever clean it up. The approach was basically, we'll figure that out later. So now here we are stuck with this stuff. For 25 years, we have these literally hundreds of tanks under the ground in Hanford, Washington, slowly deteriorating, leaking nuclear waste into the groundwater. And honestly, when you look at how much money has been spent and how little progress has been made, as I said earlier, not a single gallon of nuclear waste has been treated yet at that plant. It's questionable whether it will ever be completed.
That's right. It's hard to imagine that it would be. What is the process normally for treating this to safely dispose of this, and how long should it have taken?
Sure. So what they're doing is they are trying to vitrify this nuclear active radioactive sludge. So basically what they do is they add certain glass products to it, which effectively turns it into more of a solid format that doesn't still radioactive, but much less so at a safer level where it can be disposed of elsewhere under the ground. Right now, it's basically just sitting there in these tanks. As far as when it should have been completed, I mean, the timeline's been kicked back over and over and over again over a number of decades. In 2000, they were targeting somewhere around $6 billion to complete it by 2011. Then they moved it back another 5 years and added another $10 billion. And now the target is 2023, and the estimate is somewhere around $16 billion. So I think we should all check back in a few years and see whether that target's going to be moved again or whether they've even started treating that waste.
Yeah, certainly seems that way. And so as we're looking forward on this story, what are the next kind of milestones with it that we should be watching for?
Sure. So basically, this entire time, they've just been dumping money into building the infrastructure that will complete this plant. The current milestone is completing this giant vitrification plant that will treat this waste. I think we should all be checking in the next year or two just to ask, well, when are you going to get started? That's the first step, is when are these companies going to be able to actually start the process that they've been paid for billions of dollars for more than two decades to do?
It's really very mind-boggling. I'm so glad you joined us today to talk about this story, and we will definitely keep turning to you to keep us up to date on it. Hopefully you can join us on the program another time, because it's really stunning to think about this dollar amount and this kind of hazardous material right there in the ground as these tanks are deteriorating. So thanks so much for being with us today. Aaron Gregg, reporter covering the defense industry at The Washington Post. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. We're joined now by Justin Fox, who is a columnist at Bloomberg, who wrote a really fascinating piece about the proliferation of apartment buildings in the U.S. and why they all look the same, because they do. That's a real thing. Justin, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us today. It looks like we're having some technical stuff going on with Justin, so we'll be right back to him in a second. But essentially, this story, which if you follow me on social media, I'll be sure and tweet it out after the program. It's this piece from Bloomberg that is really, really fascinating. I want you to read it for yourself. But it looks like we have Justin back with us now. Hey, Justin, you back?
Yeah, sorry about that.
No worries.
I'm in some New Jersey wilderness and the wind was blowing.
Oh, well, thank you for joining us from the wilderness. I appreciate you.
Not quite wilderness, but yeah. So, anyway, you were asking about... Yeah, so what happened to me is I drove across the country last fall, wanted to go visit my dad out in California, and in every city I went in above a certain size, and it actually got down to, I think, Moscow, Idaho, which has 25,000 people, there were these newish-looking apartment buildings, four stories, sometimes three, mostly higher, and they just all looked really similar. I didn't mind how they looked, and a lot of them were colorful, and there's this sort of boxiness to them, and I just wondered, wow, that's interesting. And so I started asking around.
And where was the beginning of that? Once you had this idea for this story and you started kind of making these inquiries, where was the kind of the first surprise on this road for you?
Well, it was when basically one of the first people I called up was my brother, who's a lawyer who works with some real estate developers. He hooked me up with a developer, and the guy started initially thought I was just complaining about the architecture, and he went on this like 20-minute rant about how he hates the architecture of a lot of the buildings. And then finally he mentioned this term, 5-over-1. And what that means is five stories of lightweight wood frame over one story of concrete. And for me, what? These buildings are all made of wood? I had no idea, because you can't tell from the outside. So that was sort of the big aha moment.
Right, right. Which, as you note in the story, even has a piece here in Chicago related to the Great Fire of 1871.
Oh, yeah. I mean, lightweight wood frame construction, which is still the way almost every single-family house in America gets built, was, you know, there's some dispute about it, but generally it's credited to Chicago in the 1830s, this specific kind called the balloon frame. Later on, there were other kinds like the platform frame that came from out in California. But it's just this idea that you quickly throw up a house with a bunch of 2x4s or 2x6s hammered together and then slap interior and exterior walls on it. And you can do it really fast. Obviously, in the Chicago fire in 1871, these buildings proved really flammable. And so Chicago ended up banning them. It took a few years because a lot of especially recent immigrants were like, well, we can't afford a house unless we can build it this cheap way. But Chicago banned them. And in Chicago, even now, you can't. I don't totally understand what the Chicago building code is on this, but I think it's that you can't build like more than a 3-unit apartment building out of wood like this.
Well, we don't totally understand the building code here, and we live here. So
it's about to change in Chicago, so it's apparently a big thing that's coming up. They're thinking of going over to the national building code that everybody else uses.
And what did you get a sense of why that's happening, and what was prompting that?
Well, what's happened over... So after all these fires in Chicago and other places, cities started creating building codes, with fire being the biggest thing they were concerned about, but also just other safety issues and making sure the plumbing works and all of that. And for a long time, like every significant city had a completely different building code. And so there was pressure over the decades to kind of centralize it and make it more national. And for a long time, the way it worked is there was one group out of Chicago, one out of Birmingham, Alabama, and one out of L.A. that would create these model building codes that cities could use all or part of. And the one out in California was the one that was sort of most permissive about letting people build bigger and bigger buildings out of lightweight wood frames. And then in the 90s, they decided to all join together, and they made this decision that if you could build a building in any of these regions under their codes, you could build them anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's when these bigger sort of 5-story, 6-story wood frame apartment buildings started showing up all over the place.
And so
it's just over the last 5 years, there's been an incredible apartment building boom. Yeah. And so that's why they're so visible suddenly.
Yeah. And so you report this story out and you find all the things that you find and you learn all this about building codes and all this. What does it really come down to? Is it about efficiency and, affordable housing that goes up quickly, or is it really about more? Is it more of a cultural tell of that we're mostly living in apartments that all look the same? What did you start taking away from that in the deeper?
I mean, it seems like there's been wave after wave of new residential construction in this country over the past century or more, and they've generally been, you know, lots of places went up that look the same. There's sort of whatever the economic model is of a particular time, that becomes the dominant thing, and it gets built all over the place. So that's happening, and that, to me, you know, maybe some of these buildings are too big and blocky, and maybe because they're lightweight wood frame, they'll start looking kind of crummy in a couple of decades sooner than they would if they were made out of masonry. But I think in that, what turned out, and this was kind of late in the process, is there definitely are some people who are very worried that we're sort of reintroducing major fire risks to cities by having these giant wooden buildings back in the cities.
And is there like a watchdog group or anything like that that's trying to push that and to update building codes and move away from that in a larger national way?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, the cement and concrete industries are sure working on it, but sure. They actually, and I didn't get into this in great depth in the story, but they generally feel like they have a lot less lobbying clout than the timber industry and wood in general, partly because the builders like building with wood, they're used to it, and partly just because with the timber industry, it's not, you know, there's just millions of people, well, maybe not millions, but a lot of people who own timberland, and so it's sort of a more potent political force. Definitely the building codes have changed over the past few years in reaction to some of the problems that have happened. One thing is it's buildings up to four stories of wood. Residential buildings are allowed to have, they all have to have sprinklers, but these ones are allowed to have this partial residential sprinkler system that doesn't cover everything. It doesn't cover like attics or spaces between floors and such. And one thing that they discovered that was really missing is it didn't cover balconies. And everybody goes out on their balconies to smoke.
Right.
And leaves their,
you know,
stubs their cigarette out. And so grilling in a wood building. Well, it's generally the problem has been more with smoking than with grilling, but I imagine that's a problem sometimes too. And so they've changed it now, so you have to have sprinklers out on the balcony too, because that had been a big problem. I mean, so far the really big fire issue has been when they're under construction, and it's kind of crazy how many fires there have been over the really big fires over the past few years in these giant wood frame construction sites. And, you know, there are various different ways to attack that problem, but I don't know that they've totally figured that out yet. But sort of the more concerning long-term issue is whether these buildings, you know, 40 years down the road when stuff breaks down and all, are as safe as a, you know, building out of brick would be.
That's right, right. And then there's the whole other design issue, which you mentioned, kind of where it started in this conversation as you were initially reporting on this story about kind of what does it mean they all look the same?
They do, and there are lots of attempts to make them look different that end up making them look pretty similar, too. I don't mind them. I mean, at least the sort of urban style that goes up in lots of cities, which has kind of some parts jutting out and some parts in and often different colors and all. I like it now, but I can see why people would worry that won't look very good in a few years. So I get that.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's a really, really interesting story. And again, for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and tweet it out so you can read it for yourself. It is really very interesting. Justin Fox, columnist at Bloomberg, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot.
All right, we are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be taking a look. We're going to talk with Todd Leidy, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune, all about Bill Daley's background at the intersection of government and business. Lots of conversation going around about those tax returns, so we're going to talk about that with Todd back in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Lewitt here on Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. We're joined now by Todd Leidy, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune, who wrote about Bill Daley's background at the intersection of government and business. I know there have been so many conversations that we've been having everywhere in the city, but especially on this station during the Chicago mayoral campaign. And as we've been talking about all of those topics since the jump, lots of issues, but money has been a big one. Todd, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Amy.
Thanks for being with us. So talk us through the story, because there's a lot of nuance to this, and of all the mayoral candidate conversations around money and releasing taxes and all that. This one is a very special case because this is a different person with a very different background than the other candidates.
Yes, this is a Daley, Bill Daley. His brother was mayor. His father was mayor. I believe it's of the last 19 municipal elections, Daley has run for mayor in 14 of the 19. And so he's not running away from his family name, and he's not totally embracing it. He's saying he's his own man, so look at his record. And that began with us first examining how the story of how he got his insurance license and how he got his start in his business career. And that first story pointed out that he apparently had some help with a state worker filled in some answers on the exam. And the state worker was loyal to an ally of old man Daley's political machine. And so Bill Daley was able to go into the insurance business with his brother John. And then their father, the mayor, started steering city insurance business to him. And so I know a lot of millennials out there who have, you know, all kinds of college loans to pay for. We'd love to have a start out in life like that where, you know, they get a sort of leg up. And that's been one of the themes of this campaign. Bill Daley's been coming under attack by others because of his name and that legacy. And in fact, one of the candidates, LaShawn Ford, pressed Bill Daley to admit that he's benefited from what he called the family business. And Bill's response to that, Bill Daley's response, been that he's proud of his family legacy and he's proud of his career. And says most of his career was spent in the private sector. And so the latest story that we did at the Chicago Tribune was to look at that, as you mentioned, that intersection between his work in the private sector and his work in government.
And through your reporting, does it seem to be that he's just kind of too mired in both, you know, both camps to ethically move forward in politics, that given that he's done so much in business, that he has so many, all these family ties, all that, do you think this is really going to hurt him on the campaign trail?
These are all good questions for the voters, and it's, which is why we press and which voters come to expect candidates for public office, particularly for mayor, that they release their income tax returns so you can see where their investments and their financial interests are, to see whether their financial interests will conflict with their duties, you know, serving the public, right? Because ultimately, you want to know that the person there is working for you. And we see this now in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump hasn't released any of his tax returns. And it's story after story from the Washington Post and the New York Times about potential conflicts, about Saudi Arabians staying at Trump hotels, you know, near the Capitol and him benefiting from that. And so we just want to know where does that money lie and where those potential conflicts reside. Now, Bill Daley, it's been part of almost every presidential campaign since 1976. He was his father's liaison to the Jimmy Carter campaign, and he was the campaign chairman in the final weeks for Al Gore that led up to the Florida recount. And so he's revolved a little bit, not in a real big way, from government politics and the private sector. In 1993, he was Bill Clinton's architect on NAFTA. Then he was Bill Clinton's Commerce Secretary from 97 to 2000. And I was told it was at that time he met a fellow by the name of Jamie Dimon, who's the head of Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase. And Bill Daley then went to work soon after he left Commerce, went to work for the bank around 2004, I want to say, until 2011.
A lot of interesting stuff. And again, those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and share this story after the program so you can read it for yourself. There's a lot of really important details in there that, as you say, Todd, I think it's important for voters to know. I want to talk now about the Tribune obtained a copy of Daley's 43-page financial report, and that was from the Center of Responsive Politics. Tell us about that and what you learned from that report.
So when you go, want to serve in the high levels of government, like when he was Secretary of Commerce and he was Barack Obama's chief of staff, you have to fill out a fairly detailed report of all your holdings. That is not required in the city of Chicago, and that is not required to the degree in the state of Illinois. He has to give ranges of every investment he has, what boards he sits on, and not just him, but anybody in those offices. So when he became Barack Obama's chief of staff, he filled out that detailed form listing all of his holdings, that of his and of his wife's. This document is only kept for 6 years. It's usually it's compiled by the Office of Government Ethics, and so it's been longer than 6 years, so normally we would have gotten that report from them. Fortunately, the Center for Responsive Politics, as you mentioned, is where we got the report. That nonprofit group tracks the influence of money in politics, and we're able to get that report from them. And our analysis of that showed, again, you only can put in dollar amount ranges, that Bill Daley was worth anywhere between $12 million to $46 million in 2011. In fact, one of his big payouts was $15 million when he left J.P. Morgan to go work for government, and that was $15 million in salary, bonus, and pension disbursements. So he's gotten rich at this crossroads of government and politics and the private sector. And so that is really the help form the basis and the backbone for that story. And one of the ironies is, hopefully if people read the story, they get all the way to the end, but one of the ironies is when his brother, Richard Daley, was running for Cook County State's attorney way back in 1980, almost 40 years ago, Richard Daley released copies of his income tax returns. And he did that at the advice of his campaign manager, who said, given, and I quote, he decided to release these tax returns because, given, I quote, the nature of the office he is seeking. And that campaign manager was Bill Daley, who now will not release his tax returns.
Ah, how things have changed. Indeed. Well, I thank you for joining us and talking us through this story. Again, as you said, this is important stuff for voters to know, so to make decisions for themselves leading up to elections and whatnot. So thank you so much for being with us and talking about this story with us, because it is a really interesting one. And this guy in particular is interesting because he, as we've talked about, this family past and the offices he's held. And it seems like he's made a shift from someone who liked to help others move forward, and now he's trying to do this himself. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens, but we'll keep turning to you for the latest. Todd Leidy, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
All right, we are going to take a little break, and then we're going to get you to news, but not before we check in with Scott Catoon to see what's happening on the Startup Showcase today. Lots to do, I'm sure. He's always got interesting stuff. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.